In the Muscle Lab podcast, episode 2, we talk about how to apply to a PhD program. One thing we do in the Muscle Lab is graduate a lot of master's thesis students. These master's thesis students then go on to apply and attend the PhD program. The goal is to become accepted with full funding. However, I believe there's a mystery on how that application process works. It's different than applying to a bachelor's or to a master's. We have a very specific process in the Muscle Lab, which may not be the only process to go about applying to a PhD, but it is effective. So today, along with 3 newly minted master's thesis students, we walk you through that process, and hopefully it's helpful if it is a mystery to you on how to apply from a master's to a PhD. This includes an initial email, the visits, and ultimately getting funding and being accepted to a PhD program. So stay with us here in episode 2 as we discuss this process. So in this episode, guys, we're going to talk about how to apply to a PhD program. Now, we're going to look at this from the perspective of a master's student. And we have 3 master's students here today, Zach Robinson, Brian Benitez, and Becky Sermonaro. Actually, 3 newly minted masters of science, I might say, as all of these individuals, as we're having this discussion, just recently defended their thesis. So I wanted to have this discussion about how to apply to a PhD program with these individuals, because they all are going on to a PhD this fall with full funding, and they've just gone through this process. I feel that, you know, if you're finishing high school and you're applying to an undergrad, this is kind of a well-known process. Some people might have their families helping them out, but they have all of their friends at school. They can go to their counselor at their high school. They can figure that out. When you're going on to a master's degree, you're kind of finishing your undergrad. There's a lot of students. There's other professors in the department. It's a bit easier to communicate and go to a master's degree. And applying to a master's, while a little different than an undergrad, isn't too different. You might not know you want to get involved in research yet, so you might just be applying to a program, any program, wanting to learn more about a topic. But applying to a PhD is more about starting your career. It's a completely different process than applying to a bachelor's or to a master's degree. And I don't feel that this is always explained very clearly. And oftentimes, really qualified individuals that should be in a PhD program don't get to start right away because they're not clear on how to go about the application process. So that's what this episode is about. If you're listening, if you're doing a master's degree and you want to apply to a PhD, I think we're going to help. Now, ideally, you're finishing a master's as you apply to a PhD and you have research experience. That's not always the case. I actually did not have research experience personally in my master's degree because I was at a smaller teaching school. It was a great program, but I didn't have research experience. And some actually go to a PhD right out of an undergrad. I don't know how often I would recommend that, but for really qualified candidates, it does happen, and those individuals are exceptional. But for the purposes of this, let's say you have research experience, you're finishing a master's degree or a master's thesis, as these 3 students did here, and you're looking to apply to a PhD. Well, your goal, let's go through your overarching goal and then the timeline of what might be the next 9 months or so of your life in that application process. And then we'll kick it to everybody here to chime in on the topic. But your ultimate goal is to be accepted to a PhD program, but not just the program, but to be working with a specific professor and to have full funding to that PhD program. So, and I'm speaking really in terms of the United States at the moment. There are different processes for other countries, and I'm not as familiar with those. So this isn't the best place if you're looking to apply to a PhD program in another country. And you should do so if that program is most fit for you. But here in the United States, which is what I'm most familiar with, in our laboratory, we've had, I believe it's 19 individuals go on, be part of the laboratory. And we've had 100% success rate of 19 individuals that have wanted to go to PhD from a master's program have done so. And so your goal to get that full funding, that might be on a research assistantship, a teaching assistantship, funded by a grant by that professor or by that department. So let's say using the current time that we're recording this, you want to start a PhD in the fall of 2022. So in the fall of 2022, you actually need to start this process a year early. So if you're going to start in August of 2022, the first thing that you need to do in the August and September of 2021 is to compile a list of schools and professors that you're interested in working with. And I say schools and professors rather than just schools, because before you apply to the university, I would advise that you email a specific professor. Really, not for all, because some PhDs you do rotations with professors, which we'll talk about, and some PhDs you're admitted by a department committee. But for a lot of PhDs, it's most important to get a specific mentor, specific professor to want you to be there and work in his or her laboratory. So a whole year before, in August of 2021, in September of 2021, I would advise that you compile a list of no less than 20 professors that you want to email. And I'll talk about in a bit why this long list, and we'll talk about that email. But in that email, you're going to describe yourself, describe your research interests, talk about how those research interests match up with you. And each of these individuals here can talk about that a little bit more. But the main goal is that you're going to look for a good person and someone that matches up with what you want to do. And we'll come back to that. But more important than anything in this process is finding a mentor who's a good person. You want him or her to be somebody that you trust. So you email that individual. And one of the reasons we talk about getting 20 emails, I know that sounds like a lot, but right off the bat, you're not going to hear back from 10 of those individuals, maybe 12 of those individuals. So let's say that brings you down to 8. You'll hear back from 4 others, and they'll say they're not accepting students, or there's no funding that year for whatever they're doing, or they're not interested. Then that leaves you with 4 more. Those other 4, a couple of them think they have funding. They don't at the end of the day. You go visit 2. You like one, and the other one you thought you were going to like, but you don't. And you end up with 1 at the end of the day. You might end up with more. Some people here had choices and where they went, but some people didn't. And it's not really a reflection of the quality of student that you are always. It can be sometimes, but not always. It's just how that game works. And so I would email as many people that you could reasonably see yourself going to school and studying under. So you'll get an email response from them, hopefully, assuming you do, for some of those individuals. Then you're going to want to respond to them right away. They'll go through that process, just discuss the general timeline before everybody else here chimes in. And then in that email response, that professor, he or she will probably ask you to send over a CV. I would recommend having that ready before you send the email, because when they respond to you, they might take a week, 2, 3, 4 to respond to you. But you need to respond to them right away. And I think everybody here can attest to that they took a long time for some professors to respond to them. But when they respond to you, you need to respond right away. So if they ask you for a CV, have that ready before sending the initial email and send that back over to them. Then they may want to schedule an initial phone call or initial video call. They might do that with themselves. They might do that with students that are currently in their lab. After that, hopefully it goes well, and then you'll go on a visit to their program. In that time, one of the questions you might be having is, when do I actually apply to the program? The way I treat the application is when that professor advises you to apply. When you email a professor right away, he or she might say, that's great, let's continue to correspond, I'll let you know when it's time to apply. Or he or she might reply and say, thank you for your interest, please email this administrator and apply. And they might say something like, we will have an interview weekend from February 20th to February 22nd. Please come, I will meet you at that time. Meaning the way their application process works isn't through an individual professor, it's by applying to a program. But even if it is, that professor, you're still on that individual's radar. So they're still able to know you're coming, you can correspond with them and see them on that interview weekend. But if it's an individual professor, they'll respond, they'll ask you, hopefully they'll set up that video call with them and their students, and then they'll ask you to come out on an official visit. You might have to pay for that yourself, which can be difficult. Sometimes they can provide funding for you to go out. You'll apply when they advise you to apply. On that visit, and I want everybody else here, because they've been on these visits much more recently than I have, they can talk about that. But the two things I'll say is, while you're on that visit, you most importantly want to ensure that this professor is a good person, and we hit on that. You want to find an area of research, and I can't stress this enough, that you like and that you're interested in. But as long as I would advise that as long as that research interest is close enough to what you want to do, that professor is a good person, and you believe that he or she has your best interest in mind, that's the most important aspect. Because that person is someone you're going to be working with very closely for the next 4 or 5 years. And the second thing is, on that visit, you want to talk to the students that work for that individual when the professor is not around or the principal investigator is not around. And the students will be able to fill you in on what it's like to work for that person. They'll tell you if they're not having a good experience, if it's a great experience. And that's what I do here at FAU, even though we're a master's program, with any new students that come in. I advise them to talk to these students here. And, you know, I think I do a good job, but obviously I'm biased because I'm thinking of myself. These students here might say to somebody else new and say, yeah, you know, it's okay, but there's this aspect I don't like, and they should do that. And then a student can make a best decision for them. And then throughout that process, you might see separate applications for an assistantship as opposed to not being funded. But the professor that you're in touch with, he or she, again, will advise you on that. They will say, hey, I have a grant coming in. I will be able to fund you. Or they'll say, I have a teaching assistantship in the department or a research assistantship. I'll be able to fund you. And then you go on those visits and then you get a few offers, hopefully. And if you get a few offers, then you have to weigh which one you're going to take. Everything else being equal, I would go with the individual that is the person you could see yourself working with the most, the lab group that you mesh with the most. And then that concludes the process. And ultimately, I wouldn't turn down any offers until you've signed on the dotted line with where you want to go, because you never know if that funding could be pulled at the last minute. You don't want to be without funding in a PhD. You want the university or the grant to be paying for that and for you to be getting a stipend. It won't be easy to live during that process. It's not like you're going to be making a lot of money, but it'll be a great experience those next 4 or 5 years that you were there. So that's the process, compiling that list of 20 so professors. After that, facilitating the email responses, emailing that person back quickly. After that, following their guidance on when to apply, probably jumping on a video call or a phone call with some of their students or themselves specifically. If that goes well, they'll invite you out. Sometimes that invitation will be from the professor and you'll go and meet with their lab and meet with the department. Sometimes that invitation will be from the department or college specifically, and they will have an interview weekend where you might make the cut of 15 students that are invited. And then you'll interview with all of those students that weekend. And then after that, you'll be applying for assistantships where the professor will agree to fund you on a grant. And then you'll have your decision at the end of the day. So I think that's an overview. And just before we get to everyone else here, I think that's important because, again, this process is not like applying to an undergrad. If you don't contact the professor and you just find the program and you submit your application electronically, it may not even get looked at. It may, and you may be accepted. What I'm outlining doesn't mean it's the only way to do this. I just know that it's been effective for 19 out of 19 students that have come through our laboratory. So I would advise doing this, or if you have someone else that has another method, that's great. But what I wouldn't advise is just blindly applying as you would to a bachelor's without being in touch with anybody. They may not be looking for your application, or if professors decide based upon the funding they have and your name comes through cold and they see your application and they say, hey, you have a 4.0 GPA, that's great. But this other individual, he or she is applying, they've met with that person, they like that person. If they're going to, because in a PhD, they're going to fund that person and they want that person to be able to do a good job on their research and train them in the lab. So they're going to say, why? I don't know this person, even though they look good on paper. They haven't reached out to me. This other person is who I know, who I've been corresponding with. I trust that Zach or Becky or Brian is going to do a great job in the lab. I'm going to fund them. So that's the overarching process. And that's how I'd recommend going about it. So Zach, can you start us off? I know you put together, because I remember all you guys sent me your lists of places that you were going to apply. And you guys each had around that 20 amount of individuals, 20 people on that list. What was it like putting together that list? What did you look for? And Zach, can you talk about how many responses you got? If what I'm outlining came true and how that process worked from there for you specifically, and then everybody else, anything else in the process you feel you want to comment on? Anything else that I missed that you want to add? I just really think this will be valuable for everybody listening to know how they can go about this. So Zach, start us off.
Yeah. So I think obviously the first thing to say is for people that apply to undergrad, compiling 20 schools or names may seem like a daunting task, but like Dr. Zordos already said, it does, once you've kind of been through this process and you learn how fast schools and individuals get weeded out just due to the logistical nature of how this kind of process goes, you very quickly realize that, you know, 20, maybe even more in some cases, is probably a pretty good idea to really just see the pool of individuals that's out there, so you can really hone in on all the potential options. So when I went about the process, I think the first thing, like you said, Dr. Zordos, is confronting. I know we've talked to a ton of different people that have had similar experiences with this, but confronting the idea that your research interest, it can be pretty specific, but at the same time, you do need to expand it enough so that you don't just let somebody that would be a really good opportunity fall through the cracks. So one thing that I kind of did for myself, at least the way that I thought about it, is like, you know, you have your broad research interests, and for all three of us here, is roughly related to resistance training in some way or resistance exercise. But I think one thing that I always thought about was the resources that the individuals have in their lab as well, just to answer questions that you find interesting. So whether that be, you know, a bigger school that looks at skeletal muscle, even though it may not be in kind of a resistance training context, or just similar kind of extrapolations of those ideas. So I think that's the first thing, in my opinion, that you need to confront, is like, okay, here's my research interest that I would, in a very perfect world, I'd like to seek out. How far am I willing to go outside of that in terms of stuff that I could still see myself doing and find interesting? For some people, that's going to be a pretty wide range. We've had a ton of people in our lab go from doing, you know, our training studies, or, you know, stuff that's very, very applied in nature, go all the way to, you know, molecular biology. So we've had, you know, people span the entire spectrum. And then in the other direction, we've had people that stay very, very applied and go to kind of the European programs that you talked about, Dr. Zordos, that are a little bit different in structure to the ones in the United States. That, so again, we've had people kind of across the entire spectrum. So I think that's the first thing to do. And once you've kind of narrowed down kind of your range of interests, from there, you can go and find the mentors that are doing similar research questions and answering, projects in the realm that you're interested in. And I think that, again, on average, expanding that horizon a little bit wider than what you may think as a, you know, bushy-tailed, bright-eyed master's student is probably a good idea. I know all of us in this call have had that kind of really quick realization of like, I want to do this. And then you go out and start looking for mentors that have funding and, you know, are being productive and seem like good mentors you want to work with. And it's usually not a one-to-one square thing with exactly what you want to do, which is a good thing, because that's going to allow you to grow once you get there. But I think that is kind of the first thing. And then once you start compiling the actual people that you think are good fits, that's when you get to start sending out the emails. And like I said, you get to very quickly realize how you're going to get 7 responses within the next week, because it's very easy for a mentor. Just put yourself in the other person's shoes. Like, if they don't have funding, it's super easy to send that email, but to send the 3-paragraph response of when is the, you know, the interview weekend, what are all that, that's what takes more time. So, you know, you're going to get a ton of hits right back saying, sorry, you sound like an excellent candidate, but we don't have funding. We don't have any more spots in our lab. And that may feel like a negative experience, but of course it's not personal. That's just, as Dr. Sordo said, it's just kind of the way the game is played. So, but that will very quickly make you realize why it's so important to have a big pool to start, in my opinion, because you're going to get that very quick. Almost half of the potential advisors are going to be gone right off the drop of the hat. So, and then from there, it just kind of follows the natural regression of going through this process. But I've been talking for a while, so I don't know if I missed anything or anybody else wants to hit on anything.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of add to the perspective when looking for specific advisors or schools, I think just speaking from my own personal experience, initially my thought process was going into this, like, I'm going to find whatever school or program does this work and does the coolest research. And then somewhere along the process, kind of started realizing, you know, we talk a lot about finding a good mentor, someone that has your best interest at heart. It's like, if you find somebody that's going to teach you how to be a good researcher, and again, the area of study is at least within the realm of something that you're interested in, you're going to develop the skills necessary to then go off out of there and then go pursue whatever you want, because you're going to have all those tools in your toolkit, as opposed to maybe going to like your ideal dream program. Maybe the person isn't the best mentor, not because they're a bad person, but just don't have the ability to mentor you the way that you need to be mentored. And then now you're walking out of there and maybe you don't have the tools to continue on this work or the knowledge set to actually kind of understand this literature or whatever the case is. And that's something that's definitely impacted the way that I approach this process. I don't know if you guys can attest to that at all.
Yeah, so I'll chime in here. So it's funny because when I look back on my list, it's just a bunch of schools that I knew that I had at least in part some sort of interest in. The school that I will be going to is more focused on something that I particularly cared to learn based on my advisor's previous work. However, I don't think that's always the case. And like the other guys mentioned, sometimes you'll kind of lean more towards looking at larger universities that have those potential mentors. I know for myself, I actually applied to a university and I reached out to two different advisors in that same department because I knew that they had some good resources there to use. And although these two advisors did work hand in hand, one of them was accepting students and the other one was not. So in the case of just, you know, reaching out to them in regards to email, I think it's also important for us to take into consideration that you don't really want to get trapped in the noise if they're having a faculty meeting and they're talking about potential candidates for them to take in. I think it's important to let them know firsthand if you are applying, if you're reaching out to another person in their department, that way they don't, you know, both kind of bump heads with each other in that conversation. But it just so happened that they were really good friends and they were, they worked together really well. So I think that's also something to keep in mind and just something that I initially thought of.
Yeah, Becky, that's interesting. I want to follow up on that. So when you sent your, because I remember this came up, when you sent your initial emails, you reached out to two faculty members in the same department. And so as you just said, you let them know that in the email. And somewhere during the last sentence or two, you noted, hi, Dr. Smith, I've also reached out to Dr. Jones, that sort of thing. So they were aware, correct? Is that what you're getting at?
Yes. And actually, it's funny because when I wound up visiting this university to meet with one in particular, one of the professors, and I actually got the opportunity to meet with the other one, and he was open to even co-mentoring me with the other one, which was a pretty, pretty cool way to, I guess, strategize it. You know, in 2 years from now, his students might be gone. So he might have that availability to help me out, which was a great, you know, great way to do things. But being open and honest with them at first, I think is what really made them feel compelled to allow me to meet with the both of them, which I appreciated.
I agree. I think that honesty helped a great deal. I think if you didn't do that, and then you went on the visit, and you saw, you know, Dr. Smith and he or she was like, whoa, I just talked to Dr. Jones yesterday and you, who do you really want to work for? You know, and this way it makes it clear and upfront. So I agree with that strategy. You know, your situation, Becky, is great, as you said, because, you know, I hope otherwise you've been doing a good job of hiding that you hate our lab, that you have a general interest in resistance training. And so you've gotten that here, but you're going on with your new mentor and you're going to be working still with resistance training protocols at some point, but in an area that's much more specific to what you want to do. So yours is actually the best of both worlds in that you have a mentor that you really like, and you are going to be doing something that's even more specifically in your interest than what we do in the lab at FAU. Can you just mention for a moment where you're going to school, who you're going to be studying under, and the area specifically you're going to be researching? And I think this is important for everybody to hear too, because if you're listening to this, you may be familiar with that. In our lab, we look at resistance training in autoregulation and periodization and these configurations to maximize strength and hypertrophy, resistance training in exercise oncology, and resistance training to confer responses of neuroprotective biomarkers. But that's not at all what Becky's going to be doing when she goes on to the next level. So I think it's important for everybody listening to know that what you do now isn't exactly what you have to do at the next level. So if you can fill us in on all that, I think everybody would be helpful.
Yeah, so I'm going to be working with Dr. Lori Weidman at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And so there, my hope is to learn more on the menstrual cycle specifically, because as Dr. Zorda has previously mentioned, I have, you know, worked in these areas in the muscle lab. However, I feel as though my knowledge in women's health specifically lacks where I care to expand upon. And so I really want to, you know, focus a little bit more on the biochemical aspect of it by looking at hormonal concentrations and how the menstrual cycle is impacted by exercise in different modalities. And I know that for certain, some of her current students do that. And that's the main reason why I chose where I chose. And not only that, but just hearing them talk about her was also a bonus. So I'm very fortunate to have, you know, like you said, the best of both worlds, except no muscle lab there with me. So,
no more Zach. So that's good. That aspect of talking to the students, that was helpful for you. And so not to talk about anything specifically, but, you know, Becky, I think there was another place where you talked to students about a mentor and that did not go well. And it, did that deter you from continuing to pursue that, that place?
Yeah. So as soon as I spoke with the students, I appreciated their honesty, but it was a little bit too honest in the sense of knowing that moving is hard enough as it is, but then working with a mentor that you know is not going to be as, open and honest and also work alongside of you in the best manner. I think I was fortunate enough to see that through just a Zoom call or whatever it was, but luckily I didn't have to go there and see it for myself. I know that I think Brian had an experience that I'm alluding to with that. So if you want to expand upon that one.
Yeah, I mean, I visited a couple places, and there was definitely one place that I visited where there was a few red flags right off the bat to speaking with the mentor. But then when I actually went and got to walk around and speak with the students, one of the students were actually very blatant and like telling me their experience and with the full on, like, hey, if you have another option, I would strongly consider unless you absolutely want to do this kind of work. And like initially I was kind of upset at the fact that I kind of spent that time and went over there, but had I not gone, I wouldn't have gotten that insight. And just on face value, like, that program was a phenomenal program. Like, surely anybody that just looks at their website would think, I want to go here. But I've actually haven't been able to go and speak with the students and kind of get a feel for, you know, what the dynamic is like in the lab. It was a very, very different experience. So that, I think, as far as, you know, when it comes to visiting or talking to students and also visiting, right, some places you might think, oh no, like, I already like what I see from talking to the mentor or the students on through a WebEx or a Zoom call, I don't need to go. I would suggest otherwise in a lot of instances, just because there's a lot of additional perspective. And even students from other labs, right, maybe some students within the within the lab of the mentor that you're looking at might not feel comfortable kind of, you know, telling you how things might actually be, but then you see another student from another lab that isn't tied to, you know, any obligation towards this person that could actually give you a little bit more insight. So that for sure was definitely a very insightful experience.
That's exactly what I was going to hit on, Brian, is kind of defining it with a little bit more granular detail of like, okay, we've all said you got to find somebody that's a good person, but from a practical perspective, what are a few things to look for? So you mentioned red flags, Brian, and one of the things that I pretty quickly started to realize, and I've talked to other people from other programs that I know that kind of went through a similar process of like Becky said, there's a kind of honesty you can tell from a student that's talking about the mentor, but there's also comments that I would just call like empty detail, where they're not really describing anything. They're not telling you, you know, what they like about the mentor. They're not telling you any cons. So one thing I wrote down is like the sign of a really good mentor, at least from what another student would tell you, in my opinion, is generally when they do highlight on some type of, he's going to ask a lot of you. He's going to have high expectations. You know, you're going to have to work very hard. He expects good work from you, stuff like that. So that's a con in some regard. But then it comes with the very, very high praise. To me, that's the highest quality, honest, comment from a student, because we all know, having done this, research is hard, man. Like, there's days where, you know, we want to pull each other's hair out, and you know, it's not a smooth sailing process where nothing ever goes wrong and everybody's even keel all the time. That's just not reality. So I think those kind of comments to me are the ones that I put the most stock in, that have a good balance of here is the things that, you know, you just need to know coming into this, so you understand what's expected of you. But at the same time, it's extremely rewarding. You know, the lap dynamic is very cohesive, like all the positive things that are generally going to be spoken about a mentor. But if something is a kind of that empty comment where they're not really describing anything with any amount of weight, or something that's just like super negative, or, you know, that's something that's just very obvious, you don't want to go there. I think those are things to take note of. Yeah, I got another comment, but if you guys want to roll off this before I say it.
Go ahead.
The other thing I was going to say is, coming back to the, what did I write down here? Oh, the kind of coming back to picking mentors for your list and the kind of their research interest. Another thing I had a pretty consistent experience of is that you can, you know, look up the program and you can look up the resources and you can see past work that they've done. But a lot of times, at least in my experience, some of that stuff is really outdated, and reaching out to the mentor will very quickly be a good way to get you, you know, back aligned. Like for example, if we're putting in like a practical lens for all of us, let's just say there was a university that had like a skeletal muscle center and they do all this really cool muscle research that we're super, super interested in. But the last time the website was updated was like 2013 or something like that. So I'm super juiced up, send an email to this mentor. They have some of the papers that they've written that are like very close to my area, but then you email them and you get an email back. Oh no, we haven't been doing that work since 2012. We've actually got a completely different grant. So that's like another really important thing, I think, from emailing people and making sure that you get that contact, because very quickly researchers can shift kind of interest depending on the funding source that's coming in, especially at bigger universities. So having that contact with the advisors gives you a really solid picture of like what's actually being done. And, you know, that's coming from the students as well. And sometimes they'll be open to exploring options that you're more interested in, but knowing kind of what they're doing in reference to what they've done in the past is probably also pretty important when you're kind of generating that list.
You know, yet another reason to have a lot of people on your list. You know, I hope all of this is hammering home that if you come across a school or a specific person and you think, wow, this is where I'm gonna go. Not necessarily, it's not just about being good enough to be accepted to that place. Everything has to line up. In the exact year that you're gonna start, that individual's laboratory has to have a room for a student, and that individual's laboratory has to have funding for a student in that exact time frame that you want to go. You have to be able to afford to go to that exact place with the cost of living and the stipend that they're offering. You have to go and actually like the other people you're there working with. All of those things have to line up. It doesn't mean it can't, it doesn't mean it won't, but what it does mean is that it's more likely than not, if there's that place that you want to go, that the response is, hey, I'm sorry, we don't have funding this year. So I think all of these things are just really driving home the reason that you need to look at a lot of people, and you need to have that communication. So I want to ask each of everybody, if we can just do a rundown real quick. If you can remember, out of the 20-ish emails you sent, roughly, you might not remember exactly, but starting with Becky, roughly how many did you get a response, and how many did you go past the initial email to let's say, hey, let's schedule a phone call?
So if I could think off the top of my head, I think I received a response from almost everyone, but I also reached out to even more people after the initial 20 because of the—
A lot of those were no responses.
Yes. A lot of them were no funding, I don't have room for another student, those types of emails back. And the amount of people that I actually met with, I want to say were probably about six or seven.
So that's a lot. So if Becky emailed 25-ish, because she emailed more, six or seven for everybody listening is a lot, but you ended up with two offers, correct?
Yes.
And one of them that I remember we prepared for a phone call with, and you had a nice phone call with this person, they ended up kind of, their funding ended up running out, which we thought was promising, but they ended up not having funding.
That actually, yeah, that happened with two that I went outside of and applied to. So I applied to four in total, but two of them gave me the, unfortunately, something just fell through with the funding. However, the one that we were previously discussing, I really saw myself going there because I prepared so much because I cared so much about that program. And we had all of these future plans to set up virtual meetings and all this stuff, but everything just wound up falling through. And I think it's, you know, for a reason, but I do also want to mention the importance of, if you are interacting through email with an advisor or a potential advisor, they're going to want to know what you know based on their research in some way. At least this is what this particular person wanted from me. So I had to sit down and take a few weeks out of my time to analyze as much of her research as she wanted me to. And we would talk about it just to kind of see where I'm at and if it's anywhere near what she expected of me. So I think that's important to consider.
So initial contact with 20 to 25 schools, ended up meeting with six or seven, only applied to four, had two offers at the end of the day. So I, again, that's, you know, that's a low percentage. And having, and mind you, applying to four and having two offers is very good. Most people don't have two offers. Most people have one offer if they're fortunate. So, you know, Becky did a great job, but somebody of her caliber, she's a very high caliber student. I've told that to other people before, but I try not to tell her. You know, my style is you can't, you know, any other professors out there, no, you can't build these guys up. You just don't want to do it. But she's a very high caliber student. So to go from, 25 down to two, you know, that you need to send a lot. And as she said, one thing we didn't mention is you gotta prepare for these calls. You have to know what they're doing. You have to look into their work, be ready to have some knowledge base about what they're doing. Because remember, from that professor's perspective, they're looking for a good person too, hopefully, but they're looking for somebody that can integrate into their lab and they can train to do that work. So they want to make sure that you have some knowledge already in that area that you can jump right in and you can jump on the team and work on the research. Brian, how many did you send or how many replies did you get of those 20 or so? How many did you apply to? And then I'd also like for you to talk about the assistantship process because you applied for a lot of assistantships.
Yeah, so I sent emails to about 20, maybe a little bit more professors. And the first few weeks were daunting. I'm sure Zach remembers. I was calling him like every other day, freaking out. I wasn't hearing anything back. I thought my life was over. And then the first round of emails weren't very positive. So I got a lot of things. So I had professors say, hey, we don't have funding right now. You know, you can apply and maybe funding, you know, those, things will change by the time that, you know, you get here or anything. I had other professors kind of like in the email, their response, it'd be kind of like I guess I'd say gatekeeping question is a lack of better term, just to kind of see what you know. It's like, hey, what interest do you have in this particular field? Like why, you know, what can you tell me about this? And then had other professors just say, hey, just apply. We'll have interviews or, you know, we'll meet when you get here kind of thing. So I ended up actually going through with, you know, interviews and actually talking with people with about five professors. And I ended up getting an offer from one university, which is where I'm going, University of Kentucky. And I ended up applying to three. So as far as the assistantship, yeah, that was definitely a ride. So initially I applied to a fellowship at the university. And you know, hearing back from that was going to be some time. So in addition to that, I applied to a bunch of assistantships, within the university itself. So in this particular instance, like funding wasn't guaranteed. I had to kind of find other mediums to acquire funding. So applied to a few assistantships, ended up getting one. And that same week I got word back from the fellowship that I actually got that. So very fortunate, they were understanding. I let them know like, hey, I'm going to take this offer. This is better for my situation all around. They were very understanding. And so very lucky to have that. But I guess sometimes like it wasn't an ideal situation for sure, but it was one of those things where I kind of had to take that chance. It was a mentor that I liked, the research interest and kind of the tool sets that I would come out of there with were aligned with what I wanted to do. And although funding wasn't guaranteed, it was something that I had to work for and had to kind of figure out along the way. But, you know, every step of the way I had the reassurance from the mentor that, you know, we would figure something out and that, you know, I wasn't going to just get left there like, oh, well, you got to figure it out now kind of situation. So that was definitely reassuring. That was my experience.
Not to sound, too generic or, I'm not a motivational speaker. I'm no Matt Foley, greatest motivational speaker of all time. But what I heard there, Brian, was a lot of perseverance. Is that, you know, you didn't get responses at first. You had to stay with it. I think the rule that we have is if you don't get a response from a professor, from a mentor, you wait 2 weeks and then you follow up. Yep. And then if you don't get a response to the second email, you wait 1 week and then you follow up. Sometimes you get a response that third time. Don't think that it's a lost cause at that point. After that third one, then we stop. They're not interested. But then we stop, but we follow up after 2 weeks. So what I heard there was a lot of perseverance. You had to get through that. You sent those follow-ups. You finally got an in. You applied to three. It was whittled down to one. You took a leap of faith because you wanted to go there. You fought through getting these assistantships and you were able to get funding. And now you're there. You're in a great situation. You're going to be working with a fantastic mentor who she's been so far great with you, and it's going to be a great, great experience. So I heard a lot of perseverance. And, you know, Zach, I think that you, you had, I think, I don't know, a lack of responses at first or a lot of no's at first, if I remember. Yes. Similar to them. And then you had two options at the end of the day.
Yeah. So I was very similar to Becky. I ended up, I think I actually applied like closer to like 25, not applied, but emailed like 20 or 5 or 30 places. And for a while I didn't get any responses. So it was pretty, it's like a silent period. I was like, well, what the heck did I do wrong? Like, I don't know. And then I think I got responses back from just over half. So I want to say like 15 or 16. So there's a ton of people that just totally blew me off. And then from there, I think I set up calls or video calls with like five or six. One of those was a very nice person that kind of just wanted to hear me out, but told me on the call, there's no way you're getting in, don't apply, which was awesome. Very nice person, but yeah, he did tell me that. And then I talked to a few others. Most of them were like kind of saying that, you know, funding's not guaranteed, similar to Brian. So I only ended up applying to two. And then, like you said, Dr. Zordos, I ended up having two options and decided that unfortunately I will be staying under the tutelage of this man here. But it was just so interesting to me how you think that you're over preparing. And you think you're overdoing it, but you never are, because that pool just every step of the way just shrinks so much in comparison to what you've originally done. So it sounds like, again, all of us applied to, sounds like over 25, or not applied, but emailed over 25 yeah. people and narrowed it down to less than two or one offers. So it's just it's crazy.
A comment and a question. First comment is Zach doesn't know this, but the 15 or 16 he didn't hear back from, the rest of us got together and sent them videos of his deadlift, and they were like, no way. Then my question is, Zach, you suggested this at the beginning, you think it's overkill. Be honest, when I told you to put together a list of 20, did you guys at first think like, why? That's a lot. Was there any part in that process at the beginning where you were like, that seems excessive? I don't see the point in that.
I don't know. I think we're biased because we've had so many people. Like, I think, I don't know what the typical kind of rate of master's students that go on to, you know, PhDs is, but I would say ours is definitely above average if I had to guess. So we're kind of, you know, when we talk to past students, you know, especially like Jess and Trevor, who had, you know, a ton of different offers and just had multiple places, it kind of was a little bit normalized, I'd say. But, you know, when you're doing it, I think you're still like, dude, this is ridiculous. I got to look up. I think, I don't know how many, my process literally to go through school is I looked up it was like college football logos of the United States. And I would just go through those schools and see if they had any mentors or
basketball teams. You start making it down to like the 15 seeds in the tournament.
Yeah, yeah, I'm serious.
Literally, I remember them. They got blown up by Duke in 2006.
Yeah, exactly. Literally, that's how I did it. And so, yeah, when you're doing it, I think it seems excessive, but I think that quickly wears off once you get the first wave in of no.
Yeah, and you know, one other thing too. Because it's so competitive, and because as you can see, you may not be able to get exactly the place you want or exactly the research area you want. One thing I've tried to convey to everybody here and all three of you guys and everybody has done a great job is, you know, in our lab, people are probably most familiar with our work that's practical on resistance training, although we have, you know, our exercise oncology and our exercise neuroscience, if you will, type of work. But I've almost gotten to the point where I not mandate, but really, really suggest, hey, you need to do this, so that everybody here gets involved in our biochemistry laboratory. And I want all of you guys, and I think everybody here was able to do this in their initial email and in their letter of application that they ultimately have to write, to be able to note that you have wet lab skills, that you've done an ELISA, or you're learning Western blot. And if you have that, it's gonna make you that much more practical. So if you're listening to this as an aspiring applied scientist in exercise science, that's fantastic. But I do think it's good to get some wet lab bench work experience. If you do, when you email these individuals, they're going to be much more receptive and it's going to open a whole broader spectrum. And besides, at this stage, especially at the master's, you don't need to decide exactly what you want to focus on. You can do that and you're going to be that much more marketable to all these schools. You'll be able to apply to different schools than you would have otherwise. And they'll say, hey, this person won't have to come in and learn how to do this at the bench. Or my other PhD student and my postdoc just left. I don't have time to teach them these skills. Great. Brian knows how to do Western blot. He can come in and I can observe him for a day, check the box that he's good to go with it. And he can do it and have another publication and so forth. You know, Brian's thesis was looking at the responses to resistance training of neuroprotective biomarkers, brain-derived neurotrophic factor and cathepsin B. And he's going to be doing mostly applied stuff when he goes on. But I'm sure those skills were attractive to the individuals that he's going to work with. So I think if you can broaden your horizons and whatever you go on to study, you know, if you do your master's and you're doing a thesis and you're involved in the lab, over the next few years, you're going to get a few publications. And then if you go into a different area in your PhD, you'll get a few publications there. When you graduate and you're looking for a postdoc, or if you go straight to a faculty position or whatever, maybe you go for a sports scientist position, whatever you want to do with your career, you could still go into either of those fields, what you researched in your master's or what you researched in your PhD. So just because you're moving on from something doesn't mean you can't come back to it. And just because you don't do something yet doesn't mean you can't do that at the next level. That's kind of the beauty of this whole thing, is that, you know, you're gaining the skills to learn how to think, to be able to do anything. So I think that's really important.
That's like, I wrote that down actually too, is like at the end of the day, going into at least higher level academia in the realm that we're talking about, you're getting a doctorate of philosophy. You're learning how to think. It is going to be specialized in some, you know, tangible way of investigating that. But at the end of the day, that really is what you're trying to do, is you're learning the thought process behind forming questions and answering them in the best way. So that's ideally what your mentor should help you do, rather than this person is going to 100% address my kind of area of interest directly.
Yeah. So do you guys have any final pieces of advice for someone who's at this stage, who's looking to move on and says, okay, I have this process, but I still may have a question or two, or do you have anything that we haven't touched on that was unique to your situation that along the way you wish you knew going in? Brian, I see you nodding. What do you have for everybody?
So I kind of have two things. So one of them is a little bit earlier on in the process, where it's kind of like, and I can only speak to this for myself, is going into this, I initially had this preconceived notion of what I wanted to do and the kind of research that I wanted to be. So like having done what my thesis was in and having been in the biochem lab, my thought was like, I want to be able to do like real science and work in a biochem lab. And that was like what I was going for. And so a lot of the schools that I applied to initially were within that realm. And then having been in the biochem lab and having done some of that work was definitely eye-opening, in that although I do enjoy it and having those skills is very, very valuable going forward, it's not something that I could definitely see myself doing. And it was more of the infatuation of like this preconceived notion of what real science was. And then we're doing applied work and resistance training isn't real science kind of thing. So once you kind of get that, all that out of your mind and move past that, you kind of come to the realization that, as Zach mentioned, it's a doctorate in philosophy, right? What you want to know is how to formulate these questions, how to investigate certain things. And then once you have that skill set, then you can apply that in other places. It's going to be a lot easier to do that if you're in an area that you're interested in, even remotely. That was kind of the first thing. I mean, if anybody wants to add to that, I see Zach nodding there.
I have another thing I want to say, but I don't want to cut you off before you hit on the other thing you were going to mention, Brian.
The only other thing I was going to mention is maybe touching on how to bring up the discussion of funding. That was something that was very awkward for me, but I mean, we can talk about that after.
Yeah, I'll jump in real quick. I think that's a good question that most people have is, hey, when do I ask I have to get funded. You know, I can't go there with no job and take out loans. And then even then I still have to pay, you know, to live. How am I going to do that? So I need funding. They know you need funding. They're aware of that. If you apply to a PhD, you need to get funding to be able to go there, except in some, you know, special circumstances. So they're aware of that. The time to ask that is not in the initial email. It's not in the initial phone call. It's when you go on the visit. Now that might come up earlier. If it does, that's great. You take the mentor's lead, kind of whatever he or she says on that. You don't ask like specific numbers yet, but you start to say, okay, great. So are there teaching assistant options, research assistant options? And you could in the video call, if you have a video call or a phone call, especially with students, that's a great time to ask. You can say, hey guys, how are all of you funded? And they'll say, hey, I'm a teaching assistantship, I'm research assistantship. And then when you have a call with the professor, you can ask that individual, hey, so I spoke with Zach, Becky, and Brian, and Zach said he was funded on a research assistantship, Becky on a teaching assistantship, that sort of thing. And then he or she will say, yeah, we have this available, that's great, go ahead and apply for these now, or we'll discuss on your visit. And then when you get on the visit, you'll discuss and you'll talk about you know, how much those are each for and that sort of thing. But you'll kind of take the mentor's lead. If nothing has come up and you're far along in the process, it's okay to ask. But that's not an initial thing. That's something that you ease into. That will, but don't worry, it will inevitably come up because they know that you need to get funded. That's part of the process. So it should happen somewhat organically. I don't know if anybody had different experiences with that, but that would be my advice. Becky, any final words for everybody on things that were specific to you or advice you have or something that you wish you knew before going into this that you'd like to share for anybody applying?
Yeah, similarly to Brian, I had such a hard time with the funding question because it was just such an uncomfortable situation that you kind of dread it because you just don't want to hear something that you don't want. But besides that, I do think it's important. Some of the advisors that I visited, they did preface the visit with, well, fill out the application. And then if you definitely want to come here after the visit, then you can submit the application, which was helpful for me because then it's either, okay, discard, not have to spend the money on the application or go ahead and send it in. You know, I think it's important to get their opinion on the matter because I know, for example, Dr. Weidman did not want me to submit anything until I visited and I felt comfortable there, which was a big, I think that's something I take into consideration as well.
Awesome. Zach, any last words? No? Well, you know, I think that this was a really good discussion. We hope as a whole that it's helpful for anybody that's looking to apply. This doesn't mean this is the only way to go about the application process. There may be a mentor that you currently work for in your undergraduate or your master's that has another method that's been very successful for them. And by all means, you should follow that because you have that person to be able to advise you. But if you're looking to know what to do, it's just kind of a mystery almost on how to go about it. I do think starting off with that initial list, contacting somebody, following their lead on an email, whoever you get those responses from, having that initial list of 20, finding the right person, ultimately doing the phone call and the visit, going from there, and really getting to know and trust that person and those students. I think that's a good model to be able to do it. I hope it's helpful. I hope that somebody can listen to this and say, I didn't know, but now I have some direction. We have a Google form that below this on YouTube and on Anchor that you can fill out if you have more questions for something you'd like us to cover that we didn't cover, or questions specifically for us, or on our Instagram for how you might go about this if something else pops up. Otherwise, thank you for listening, and we'll see you in episode 3 next month.